This is not a lightweight decision. And when you're ready, I want you to read that to me in the first person. And he will read, I have decided that hereafter in this realm of life, God is going to be my director. He is the principal. I am his agent. He is the father. I am his child. And I will say, I think you've made an excellent decision. I think it's a great decision. And I want to make a pact with you. And the pact is that that decision will stand until the day you formally change it with me or one of my successors. When I take someone through these steps again, I do not ask for another third step decision. I don't need to keep making this decision. Don't need to keep doing it. I say, your decision's still firm and in place? Yes, good. We'll move right along. Don't want to fool with that. So let's make a pact on that. And we move on. I think you're familiar with the third step promises. They're beautiful. I'm not going to read them. I think the next portion of this step, that decision having been the third piece, is to read this third step prayer. And let's understand what it says. Not pray it now, but let's read it now. Offer myself to thee. And that's not give me a little help and I'll take it from here. Take me. I didn't ask you what the plan was. I don't care what's going to happen. If it's your will, it suits me. There's serious doubt as to how much more I could stand of my will. Build with me and do with me as thou wilt. To build, frequently we have to tear down something that's already standing there. I'd like to warn you, if you haven't done this prayer, your life's going to change. And some things you don't like are going to happen. Some things you like to keep are leaving, and they are not coming back. And some things that you're not going to be that fond of are going to show up and throw out an anchor. They are staying. Right? It is, however, a package deal. Have a look here. I got two bowling balls. I got God's will. I got Scott's will. Pick one. Not 95 and 5. Not I'll cover sex and money. He can get the rest. That's not it. That is not the package. It's not the package. It's pick one. That's what we're asking you to do here. Pick one. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Bondage means slavery. I am enslaved by self. Why? So I can do it his way. Because it works. Take away my difficulties for one reason. Victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. The word amen does not appear. And I'm just going to observe that. I don't have an editorial on it. The amen appears the first time after that on page 76 at the end of the seven-step prayer. And I've got some friends that say they believe that everything between the third-step prayer and the seventh-step amen is a prayer. I don't know. I think it's a beautiful thing to say. I don't know. Pretty good observation. So now we understand the prayer. And then it says, back on 63, we thought well before taking this step. I want to recommend you think well. That's what it says to do. That's a direction. Think well, making sure you're ready. And then it says, we found it advisable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person instead of wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. Better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. So we have here an invitation to take this third step prayer with someone. So you need to select someone and invite them and schedule a time to do it. And I think that's one direction. You can count this any way you want to, but these are separate portions of step three to me. And then it says, the wording was, of course, quite optional. So here's an invitation to write your own third step prayer. And the book offers that. I offer it. It says prayer. It doesn't say litany. Yeah, let's just express the idea. And then I think the next thing that we do is pray the prayer. It is the first real action following the decision. It implements the decision. It is the beginning action. The difference for me between an intention and a decision is that an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision is followed by action. That's how you can tell. And I have fun with this. The book is not specific about when to do a four-step. Not at all. You're going to hear it in meetings if you haven't already. People will say, don't take a four-step too soon, you may drink. I haven't seen that. I've seen a couple hundred thousand way too late. Yeah. Or they'll say, take one step a year. What page is that on? I hear people say, don't make any major decisions the first year. I'm taking a look here at this third-step decision. I think that might be a major decision. How about don't ever make a serious decision without consulting your sponsor? That one seems to work for me. And I don't mean to do the soapbox. I like to. So anyway, I say the book makes two time references, and I believe if the book gives leeway, I should give leeway as a sponsor. And it makes two time references, and I believe that the man can use either of those two or anything that lies between them. Does that not seem fair to everybody? So I now ask him to begin reading at the bottom of the page. We're just up from the third step prayer. It says next. I said, whoa, that's a time reference. Right there, next. Okay. Launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Who all attempted a personal house cleaning before getting to AA? Yeah, a couple. All right, that's great. Not too many. Though our decision, okay, that was our third step decision, was a vital. Vital from the Latin vita, meaning life. That means necessary to life. So this is only for the ones that want to live. Everybody else is dismissed. Was a vital and crucial step, and it could have little permanent effect unless at once. That's a time reference. So the fourth step is commenced after the third step, either next or at once. Or anywhere in between. I think that's fair, don't you? Yeah, okay. So we start on a personal inventory at step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. The businesses that I deal with take a full tear-down inventory once or twice a year. They do a computer update every night. That's, for me, the evening half of step 11. But they do a full tear-down inventory at least once a year. It says, taking commercial inventory is a fact-finding, in fact, facing process, an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of. And it said that up above. I missed it when we came by. Followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of. Twice on this page, they're telling me we're going to get rid of in step four. And I would observe that if all you do in step four is write, you will get rid of time, paper, and ink. And none of those were blocking me. So it must be there are things other than writing involved in step four. First clue, okay? To get rid of them promptly without regret. Next paragraph. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. There's the good news again. My sponsor, he finally had to take it off his answering machine because he'd answer the phone too many times. People say, no, hang up. I want to call back and hear your message. And you dial his number and it go ring, ring, click, click. It ain't them. It ain't them. It ain't them. Leave a message. Beep. I was on his answering machine for about 2 years. It says, being convinced itself manifested in various ways of what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Okay, overview, step four, big book. I took a psychobabble alleged step four. I think some very well-meaning people have written some stuff I'm not real fond of, and they allege that it's step four. And I got through one of those when I was out of treatment. It's real hard for me to talk about because I'm really trying to clean up my language. But I'm not fond of those. I like the real four-step because it's life-changing. And I find the four-step to be a series of lists, observations, and prayers. It is my experience that the writing portion of the four-step has very little, if any, therapeutic effect. The observations, not what I happen to notice, but the observations specifically called for, and the prayers are life-changing. Step four is not about writing, although there's writing involved. And we the manifestations of self that we do these observations, writing lists, observations, prayers on, are resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. Those are the three portions of self. Okay, so we begin looking for directions. It says resentment is the number one offender. I wonder how important that is. It destroys. I think they've just threatened my life again. More alcoholics than anything else from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. This may be bad stuff. Been not only mentally and physically ill, been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady, it's another word for sickness, is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Seems to me that the spiritual must be the most important one. If I can get that one fixed, the other two snap on their own. Maybe I need to be focused on that one. It says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. To me, that's not a direction. That's a general description. They're going to tell me exactly how to set them on paper. It says we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. That's the first direction. And when I sponsor someone, we stop right there. A list is a series of words and phrases that run down a page. Don't believe I've ever seen a list that ran across a page. Very specific. Runs down the page. And the format that I like to use, I usually ask them at this point, you're probably wondering what color paper you should use and what color ink. Were you wondering that? And about half of them will say, yeah. Page 67, about two-thirds of the way down, says, when we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. That's just the attitude that I take. Whatever your sponsor says suits me, fine. I don't think that's very specific. It doesn't say black ink, white paper. Clearly that could be black paper, white ink. And I sponsored a guy who went to the art store and he bought an inch thick of black paper and two pens of white ink. Oh yeah, and he's still sober and he's in his mid-teens now. And he just kept saying, I don't believe this will work for me. And I kept saying to him, do you believe that I believe this will work for you? And he said, yes. I said, well, we'll just go on mine. That'll be good enough. And he was so foggy he couldn't argue with that. And he's still sober. All right, now whatever you do suits me. I require the men that I sponsor. It's an attitude. All right, I'm going to have you laughing about some of the other things when I go to that kind of detail. It's an attitude. And for me, the attitude is I don't care what it says. The first time I say, well, I really don't have to do that one that way, I could let myself off the hook on the one that was going to save my life. I'm scared of that. So what I recommend that they do is a spiral notebook seems to be an easy way to do this thing. And it's funny, a lot of them get one that either has a black cover with white writing or a white cover with black writing. I don't ask for that, but they do it. And then on the inside cover, I suggest they write something like, this is my four step, put it down. If I find you with it, I will kill you and hide your body. Something subtle. I've cheated and looked ahead. We're going to do a four-column inventory. So I asked them to write the number one above the margin on the left-hand page, number two above the center of the left-hand page, and the three and the four split the right-hand page roughly in half. And I asked them to do 30-minute sessions. My rule of thumb is three times a week. Now, I sponsor a fellow who was a stay-at-home dad, and his wife worked. That was their deal. And his son took a nap from 1 to 3 every day. I think he can do more than that. Sponsor a guy with a wife and five kids and two jobs. I don't think he can do that much. Here's some fun for you. There are 168 hours in a week. If you've got a 15-minute commute to work, that's 45 hours a week for the job. Sleep 8 hours a night is 56 more. If you go to 7 meetings a week and you go early and stay late, which I'm going to ask you to do, that's 15 more hours. A little recreation, maybe a round of golf, something like that, 3 hours. Mow the lawn, do your melon list. You know, honey, do this, honey, do that. 2 hours. 5 hours a week reading spiritual literature, conference approved and non-conference approved. 3 hours a week bathing and having a shave. 4 hours a week on a date if you're married. Coaching Little League, maybe if you're not, that kind of thing. 5 hours a week on the phone with me and to some other fellows who I'm going to ask you to check in with. 12 hours a week cooking and eating meals. 1 hour a week shopping, groceries, clothes, whatever. 5 hours a week, prayer and meditation. That's a bare minimum number. 10 hours a week, watching television. That's 3 ball games. That ought to be plenty. That's 166 hours out of your 168 hour week gone. That leaves 2 hours. I want 3/4 of that. And I want you to schedule it. I want you to call me on Sunday, and I want to know when your 3 half-hour periods are going to be. This is just how I do it. I think there are a lot of right ways to do this. This is just how I do it. And I want your schedule. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is not a schedule. Monday, 7 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., that is a schedule. That's what I want, and I expect you to do it. I want the first 5 minutes of that in prayer and meditation, asking God for whatever you want, but include clarity of mind to find what He'd have you find and the courage to put it on the paper. And I want 25 minutes of writing. It says we listed. Oh, and I want to tell you this too. I see a lot of people starting on step four, and what they do is they give themselves the assignment of completing step four. If you do that, you're in perfect position to hate yourself till it's done. I've hated myself long enough. If my sponsor and I can agree on how much time per week I should spend on this, and I spend that time, I can feel good about myself while I'm in process. I think it's a better plan. I do not allow a guy to schedule step 5 with me until I'm sure he's finished with 4. I'm not going to let him bash himself into staying up all night finishing 4 because he has an appointment with me on 5. I don't buy that. I want to be involved in the process, that's all. I also, the first time I get my hands on his 4th step after he started, I give him his grade. It's a big red F minus on the front. They all get F minus. Because we're going to have to do it again. It said a business takes no regular inventory, usually goes broke. And what that is permission not to do it perfectly. Because if you have to do it perfectly, you can't do it at all. So it's permission not to do it perfectly. I think that's really important. It's not permission not to do your best. It's permission not to do it perfectly. They're very different. And I like to remind them that we are not saving an alcove in Akron at the AA Hall of Fame for your 4-step. That you're not going to do that kind of... As a matter of fact, my home group does not give a trophy every year for the best 4-step. And this is the trophy you are not going to get. For those who can't read it in the back, it says 4-step trophy, never awarded. This is a trophy you're not... You can have your picture made with us later if you like. But this is a trophy you ain't getting. It's all part of the same concept. And the concept, it's okay not to do it perfectly. It's not okay to not do it. So let's get started. And that's what I'm going to want to talk about while we're in process here. Let's get started on this thing. 5 minutes of prayer and meditation. 25 minutes of writing. And I want a list of everybody and everything you have ever been angry with, even if you're absolutely certain you've already forgiven them. The rule is, when in doubt, write it out. If you're not sure, put it down. If it turns out later it's not a resentment, the loss is going to be 15 or 20 seconds and a little bit of ink, a little bit of paper. If it turns out you missed one, the book says it will destroy you. Choose your consequence. Which one of those did you like the best? Me too. All right, and so what I want them to do on this thing is to, down the margin, write one name, skip one line. Write one name, skip one line. That was not an estimate. Those were exact counts. Right, now, I understand the thing about your father and you want to save several pages. One name, one line. One name, one line. That's important to me. And when you get to the bottom of this page, you have to turn the page. Because clearly we've got other columns to do on this. Turn the page, write 1, 2, 3, 4, and keep it going. And I want them, forgive the word, I want them to puke them. Just as fast as you can think of them, write them down. When they slow down, on the facing page 65 at the bottom, it says we went back through our lives. I think that indicates we begin at today and work backwards chronologically. So throw them as fast as you can. When they slow down on you, go up, sit a minute or two, can't think of one. Then let's begin with today. All right? And I'm married to this wonderful woman, and I work for this company, and we live in this house, and I got this home group, and this church, and this group of friends. But 8 years ago, I was married to, what's-her-name, and I was working for this other company and all of that stuff. And then before that, I was living in San Diego, and then before that, I was in the Air Force, and I was stationed at, and then before that, I was stationed at, and before that, I was in college, and then before that, I was in high school. And you go chronologically back through your life analyzing it. And looking for anything or anyone you have ever been angry with. There will probably be a major political party, maybe more than one. Major political figures, a church, maybe more than one. Foreign countries, national figures, exes. Just list all your family members. Don't worry about it. Just put them down. Right? Y'all interrupt, try to make a mistake on this. And you just keep them coming. And when we get to your earliest memories, and you can't think of any more, your childhood, we're finished. Now, at this point, we're not complete, but we are finished. At that point, I want you to start carrying a pencil and a piece of paper with you all the time. Because you're going to be walking through the grocery store. You're going to see that cantaloupe. So that sucker's head looks just write it down. We'll add it to the list. And when they get to that point, then we go to direction 2, which is still on page 64. It says we asked ourselves why we are angry. Let's have a look at the facing page, the example. I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, the cause. His attention to my wife, told my wife or my mistress, Brown may get my job at the office. If you would, begin with the word office and count backwards on those words under the cause. See how many that is. Somebody?
19 words.
19 words. This guy is messing with his wife. Has told his wife about his girlfriend and is trying to get him fired and take his job. He got 19 words. All right? 19 words. And if you have done this list, like I've suggested, you have a name, and under two, you have the space all the way over to the spiral and the line below it. And you can get 19 words or less, and there is a summary. It's a summary. And it doesn't say, oh, it was a cold, rainy Wednesday afternoon. All right. Nah, we're not starting there. Mm-mm. That's why you can't have 5 pages for your father, because all you'll do is feed the resentment. We're not here to feed it. We're here to dig it out. Step four is about digging poison out of your soul. That is exactly what step four is about. Literally, exactly, digging poison out of your soul. That's what this portion of this inventory is about. Not yet, but that's what we're coming to. And if you work across the page, there are two reasons to do it vertically. The first one, and most important, is the book said list, and they run down the page. The second one is if you work across the page, you'll tend to feed the resentments. Working vertically down the page, do column one, then column two, it's much more analytical. You won't fire them up near as high. I see a lot of people nodding. Okay, that's great. So we do that, and then column three, top of page 65, on our grudge list, opposite each name, our injuries, was it our self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal or sex relations, which has been interfered with, five-part multiple choice test. Five-part multiple choice. Column three. Write them down. It's that simple. For me, I think the most powerful directions in this book, I've seen more lives change here, are the ones that lie between columns three and column four. It is the directions that do not call for writing. The observations and prayers that are absolutely life-changing. And we're going to cover those in the next session. We're going to take a 10-minute and 15-second break right now. We're going to start back at 11 o'clock sharp.
I'm Bob Darrow, and I am an alcoholic. The room's thinning out. That must be. We must be on step four almost. You know, I started doing these step workshops back in the mid early '80s, and I started them because all of a sudden I had too many guys to sponsor to individually take through the steps. We started doing it as a group, and for years. We would start out with 20 or 30 people, and by the time we get to step four, we'd be half. And then we'd lose a few more. We'd lose some at nine, too. We'd do the same thing. It's still going on, only we get 80 people to 100 people, and by the time when we get to step four, we might lose 10, maybe. And they go through the whole thing. And it's a nice feeling. Couple things, segues, before I get into the thing that where Scott left off on step four. This thing about the first of all, we had to quit playing God. You know, this is really what we're going to look at is how do I play God? And we're going to look at that in step four. I didn't know that I played God. I used to go to my sponsor in early sobriety, and I would make these little mental lists of how out of line people were. You know, like the people at work that aren't coming on time and they're stealing and they're not working as hard as everybody else. And then I had long lists of people in AA. You know, she's just here looking for a husband and he's a 13-stepper and he doesn't put any money in the basket. My God, he's selling Amway in the parking lot. You know, and he lies in meetings and she sounds like a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore and that guy's full of crap and, you know, on and on. And I go to my sponsor, I tell him he's a mentalist and he'd always say the same thing to me. He says, you got to quit playing God. And I think, I'm not playing God, I'm reporting accurate information here. playing God. And I was playing God. I climbed up on the throne of judgment in a state of separation, just like all the examples that Bill uses. The retired businessman lolling in the Florida sunshine, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister sighing over the sins. I'm creating the separation based on my ego, based on self. The separation, the ism is I separate myself, and it starts with my judgment. And what am I really trying to do here? When I'm asking God in this third step, what am I really trying to do? I'm trying to get out of management. I'm trying to get out of the driver's seat. And what am I turning over, really? You know, it says, made a decision to turn our will, and it says will first, and then our lives over to the care of God. I didn't know what will was. And I went to it in the early, about 1980 or so, I went to a Joe and Charlie seminar. And Charlie says, your will is your thinking. Well, that's close, but it's not all my thinking. Because I can drive down the street and see somebody I know and say, oh, that's Bill. And just keep driving. And it's a cognizant thought. I recognize Bill. It's the thinking edged with self and the thinking involving judgment. Right? And how do I play God? What is my... I was at an attorney years ago and I was making a will because I started to own some properties and different things around Las Vegas, and I knew I needed to have an estate or will for my daughter. And this attorney says to me, he says, you know, when you're making your last will, he said, really what you're doing is you're making your last judgment. Your will is your judgment. It's the judgment. You judge these people to be idiots. They don't get anything. You judge these people to be cool. They get something. You reach out from the grave. It is your last judgment on your fellow man. And when he said that to me, all of a sudden, a lot of the things started to make sense to me. The reason why in my first several years of sobriety, I would be constantly trying to turn my will and my life. But I'm really, what I'm doing is I'm turning my life over to the care of God. And without realizing it, I'm retaining my opinion and my judgment. And if you do that, it's like, here, God, here's my life. And there's a list coming of how it better go. Because you know what? And then I get depressed. Because you know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. All right, you know, there's an old biblical story. It's funny how, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I was able to revisit some of the things I was adamantly opposed to in my childhood and see them from a different light. Maybe often a light differently than they intended me to see them in Catholic school, but a light that makes sense to me in the light of my own spiritual awakening. And the biblical story of Adam and Eve, I see today in a different light. Now, here's Adam and Eve have been given heaven on earth, been given paradise, the Garden of Eden. It is perfect. And everything is perfect. And they're given one suggestion. We suggest you don't eat the fruit from this one particular tree. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, I don't know if this was the intent of the biblical writers, but it's I picture, they couldn't resist. First of all, they said, thou shalt not, which made the just put a neon sign on that tree. You know what I'm saying? I'm that kind of guy. I don't even want to do something until you tell me I can't. You know, I can't make it past the do not touch wet paint sign without going like that. I just, something about me. And this fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, I think they were in heaven and they ate that fruit and they got the knowledge of good and evil. They got the judgment. And all of a sudden they lost paradise. Because all of a sudden what had been paradise, Adam's going, God, there's crabgrass. What the hell were you thinking? Eve's got cellulite. God, what's going on here? There's flies. This is crap. What is it? And was heaven became hell. And what changed? Nothing. Except that they got their judgment. And one of my great mentors was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And Chuck helped me a lot. And Chuck used to tell a story about sitting in this chair in his house, married to this woman, working in this plant. And he said he'd sit in that chair and feel like he was dying, feeling like he was in hell. And then many years later, he found himself sitting in the chair, after getting sober, working these steps, finding himself sitting in the same chair, married to the same woman, with the same kids, working at the same place. And he felt like he was heaven. And he said, maybe heaven's just a new pair of glasses. Maybe I put myself in hell. And I know what it's like to be in hell. I know what it's like to be in that state of separation, separate from you, separate from God, alone unto myself in my own discontent, playing God. And I'll give you a novel thought that has been true for me. I have never had a situation in my life ever that's been a problem, but I've had some judgments that were problems. It is my judgment of my life. I stop being the old Chinese farmer and I become the I know guy, and the I know guy has opinions of everything. And that's where the conflict ensues, is I start to argue with life. And people who argue with the truth get sick. And I got sick. I was very sick. So we're looking for the things in us which had been blocking us. And it talks in the top of page 64, it says, though our decision in step 3 was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by an effort, by a strenuous effort, to face and be rid of the things in us which had been blocking us. The things which had been blocking us. That's why without step 4, you can't turn your will and your life over the care of God. Without 4 through 9, you're blocked. You can't do it. You cannot do it. And you must do it. You must be free of this selfishness you muster. It kills you, and yet you can't be free of it. I can't. And that's why in my early sobriety, I suffered from alcoholism because I did a crappy version of the steps, you know, your life story, but I never did this. And as a result, I never dismantled my judgment machine. And I am spending my first 4.5 years of sobriety continually trying to give God my life and running the show at the same time. And that is a hell unto itself. Right? That is a hell unto itself. And I would be the guy in the meeting, if the subject was step 3, I'd say, I don't know what's wrong, but I keep turning it over and taking it back. Well, I never turned it over, really. I've still retained, I'm trying to give God my life, and I'm retaining my will, my judgment of how things should go. I'm still the great I am in my own life. I'm still the center. I still think I know how it should go. God, what's wrong with you? You didn't cure this guy's cancer. And God, you didn't give me a better job. And God, you made it. And she left. God, why'd you leave? You know, on and on and on and on and on. I got these judgments that are keeping me in hell, when really everything was in divine order. And I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it. And step in the 12 by 12, there's a passage that was pointed out to me when I was 4.5 years, a little over 4 years sober. I was a little over 4 years sober. I'm going to 10 or 12 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. I'm sponsoring guys. I'm very active. I'm a DCM. I'm a chairman of a conference. I'm very active in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am dying of untreated alcoholism in the rooms of AA because I'd never really cleaned house. I did my life story, but I never dismantled the judgment machine, and I was dying here. And there's a description of this illness, of spiritual illness that happens to us as a result of not cleaning house in the 12 by 12. And this guy read this, pointed this out to me, and I read it, and it was me, exactly. And it comes from page 56 in step 5, and it's about the fourth line down in the first paragraph where it starts with some people. If you have a 12 by 12. If you don't, I'm going to read it. 12 by 12, yeah. It says, some people are unable to stay sober at all. Others will relapse periodically until they really clean house. Even AA old timers, and this is the part that hooked me because I figured 4 years or so, I'm an old timer, right? Even AA old-timers, sober for years, often pay dearly for skimping this step. And here's how we pay. They will tell how they tried to carry the load alone. And at that point in my sobriety, everything was very serious. Everything was very heavy. Everything was a big deal. People at one of the AA clubs in town, and some guy accused me of having my sense of humor surgically removed. I mean, you know, I'm the guy who's sitting in the meetings. I have no sense of humor. I share at people in the meetings, right, to straighten them out, right? I share, oh, I'm a sight, I'm the vision for you, I'll tell you. And you loved me. How they tried to carry the load alone. How much they suffered of irritability. I'm not irritable, but I am painfully aware of what's wrong with everybody. How they suffered of anxiety. I would spin in my head. It's crazy. I just worry about it. I wake up afraid. I wake up anxious and apprehensive, and roll over it as if... I love what Dr. Silkworth says. He says, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Like, as if it is normal to be neurotic and worry all the time and be full of apprehension and anxiety. I'm that guy. I'm suffering from anxiety. It says we suffer from remorse because when you're irritable and occasionally you go off on somebody and then I feel like crap later. Whether it's a waitress in a restaurant that hasn't waited on me quickly enough because she doesn't know who I am and then I go off on her and I read her the riot act and storm out of there and I'm never going to eat here again. And then I go sit in my car and feel like I want to go out in the garden and eat worms because I feel ashamed of myself because I've just acted like someone who I wouldn't like, right? I've become the guy. And remorse is when I become the guy I wouldn't like, right? So I suffer from remorse and depression. I have always been the type of alcoholic that has suffered with untreated alcoholism. One of my two primary symptoms are anxiety and depression and loneliness. And I'm convinced if I could find her, I'll fix all that. And it never works out because I'm coming from a place of need and a place of vacancy. Relationships are for adults. They're not for crippled children, emotionally crippled children. And so I'm suffering from depression, and it's not clinical depression, even though I know that depression. I had been diagnosed as clinically depressed by a very competent psychiatrist, and it looks like clinical depression, but it's really not. It's spiritual depression. It's the depression of the obsessively, overly self-involved. My spirit gets depressed because I smother myself with myself. I just get me right here and my emotions and my life and my anxieties and my fears until I'm just totally alone, consumed in myself, and I sink into the abyss. And I started having bouts of that again. That's a hideous thing. A hideous thing. And it wasn't real clinical depression. It was untreated alcoholism. I was not relieved of the bondage of self. I had not dismantled my judgment machine. I was locked in the conflicted position between me and God's universe. As it says in the big book, I'm looking for the things in me which had been blocking me. Not only blocking me from carrying out the decision I made in step three, until I dismantle my judgment machine, I can't turn my will. I can't give my will up. I'm not giving my will up. I'm retaining my will. And to see in this thing the exact nature of my wrongs, how wrong I had been about everybody, how wrong I'd been about my parents, how in my self-centered perception and judgment of them, how wrong I'd been about the women in my life and the employers and the police and society, and how wrong I had been in my judgments and my fears. The things I was so... Every fear I had was a judgment. It was this is going to be awful and terrible. I got to protect myself from that. Somewhere I make those judgments. And then sometimes I make them come true. Right? So how wrong. I'm looking for the things that blocked me from carrying out the decision of step three. And also blocked me from the great reality deep down within me. The book said I was blocked from God within me. I was obscured by pomp, by calamity, by worship of other things. My need to be right. I was so full of myself. I was blocked. I couldn't find God, and I'm also blocked from you. Alcoholics of my type with untreated alcoholism, as my spirit gets sick, I live in a state of separation from the people around me. That peculiar, sick, secret loneliness of being in a room full of people who I intellectually know care about me, and yet I'm the one guy here that doesn't belong. And I don't know why. A state of anxious apartness that, as Bill talks about it in the 12 by 12, that feeling that it's all of you and then there's me. And it's an exquisite type of loneliness. And the only thing, the danger of that is, the only thing that ever freed me from that instantaneously when I can't stand it anymore has been 5 shots of Jack Daniels. And I could come out and play. And the danger for me is that if I stay in that state of separation, blocked and separate and depressed and anxious and all the stuff that is part of my untreated alcoholism long enough, I will start to yearn for freedom. And I will start to hunger to bust out. And the only thing that can bust me out when my emotions and my spiritual malady is putting the screws to me is to take something, take a drink. And hope against hope that maybe this time it'll work like it did when I was 20 years old, even though it hadn't the whole 3 or 4 last years I drank. And the insanity of alcohol returns and I drink again. And I don't drink because I crave alcohol. I drink because I crave freedom. I crave freedom. Freedom from the bondage of self. Something I can't get because I haven't dismantled the things in step 4 and 5, 6 and 7 that keep me locked into and a hostage of my own self-involvement. I'm a prisoner of me. Everywhere I go, the minute I get there, it's all, what does it have to do with me? I am a prisoner, hostage to my own self and shackled to my own self-concern, my own self-involvement, my own self-obsession. So Scott was started to set up the beginning, the first half of the resentment process. And it's kind of like in two halves. The first half, the first 3 columns, this is the easy part. We're taking the part of the prosecuting attorney. We've got our lists, and you know, there we got them, and they've been there for years. And I really loved what Scott said about keep it short and to the point. To the point. Because I have case files built on people, you know. Well, what was wrong with your second grade teacher? Do you got an hour? You know, I could. And really, the real resentment was not the fact that she hurt my friend. She punished my friend Welly and my friend Tommy, and she was uptight woman, and the vow of chastity had gone to her brain, and none of that stuff was. That was all peripheral reasons to hate her. What really happened is that she got me up in front of the class one day and embarrassed me for not doing my homework. And I felt public humiliation. There's nothing worse than that. And from that moment on, I looked at her with that perception that only a judgmental alcoholic can have. And I just looked for anything to keep my case alive because I couldn't justify within myself hating her as much as I did for what she did. So I had to build the case. But the real truth was that she embarrassed me in front of the class. That was the truth. And because of that, I looked for every little thing she might have done wrong and just kept my case alive. So now, to get free of this, on page 66, it gives us 7 death threats. This is the strongest death threat page in the book. And they're not being dramatic. When it says in that one line that these things, that this resentment will cut us off from the sunlight of the spirit and the insanity of alcohol will return and we will drink again and with us to drink is to die. That is an accurate demonstration of relapse. I get shut off, locked up inside myself and I need freedom. I'm locked up in here and I got to bust out. And if you've ever been sober with a deep-seated resentment, you're completely cut off from God and your fellow man. If you, especially if you have a resentment towards someone in AA. Oh, you can't hear. And if they're in the meeting, you can't hear nothing in that meeting because you're thinking at them the whole time. And if you share, it's nothing of any consequence. You're sharing at them. You're trying to straighten them out. You're trying to throw a little innuendos in there to let them know how out of line they are and how wrong they've been. I mean, you can't. God could be trying to talk to you through the people in the meeting. You don't even hear it. You can't pray when you're like that. I mean, you can go through the motions. You can get down on your knees and say, God, please help me to stay sober, and I really wish that son of a bitch would die. You know, it bleeds into everything. It owns you. It owns you. So it says, it's in the bottom of page 66, it says, we turn back to our list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared, and this is very important. Am I prepared to look at these from an entirely different angle? Everything rests right on that, how I answer that question. Am I prepared? If I still want to be right more than I want to be free, I ain't ready here yet. If I still insist that my case is valid and I don't want to give it up, if I want to rather be right than be at peace, if my ego, if my lack of self-esteem and I value myself so little that I would rather live in the pain and agitation and gratify my ego by being right about you, if I'm still locked in that position, then I am not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle because I'm still emotionally vested in my judgment and I won't let it go. But if I am prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle, it says we will begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. Fancied or real. I'll tell you something. I found that most of my resentments in some form or other were fancied to some degree. There may be a kernel of truth in some of them, and then I will build a whole big case around that until it's more fancied than real. And when it says that these things, fancy to real, have the power to actually kill, I'm telling you, they're not kidding. I'll share a little story with you. Something that happened to me when I was fairly new. I used to go to, when I first got sober, I went to mostly nighttime meetings. And there was a guy, an old-timer in AA named Billy. And Billy was sober quite a few years. And he was one of those guys that would reach out a lot to the new people and try to include us and bring us out to coffee after the meetings. And in coffee shops, I was really spoon-fed a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous after meetings and before meetings. And one night, I'm with this guy, Billy, and it's just him and I in this coffee shop. Everybody else had left, and we're sitting around. And I found myself, because he was easy to talk to, telling Billy about those couple things that were my big secrets. The couple things that I was the most ashamed of. It says in the 12x12, the things I would have liked to have taken to my grave. And we all have those. I've never met an alcoholic yet that doesn't have something. And it might be different for every one of you. Maybe for some of you, it's you were drunk and you left your kids alone for hours and you just forgot about them. Or maybe you beat your kids in a moment of rage or drunkenness and you just the thought of it just makes you want to crawl under a rock. Or maybe you did some things to your mom and your dad. Or maybe you stole some money and let somebody else take the blame for it. Or maybe you lied about some people and it really hurt them. Or maybe you had some sex that when you think about it just makes you cringe. Maybe it was outside your species. I don't know. But whatever, we all have some stuff like that. And it doesn't make you anything except alcoholic to come here with that stuff. Don't make you a bad person. I've heard everything in fifth steps from murder to child abuse to everything you can think of. We all have that stuff. And I shared some of that stuff with Billy, that my big secrets, the to the grave stuff. And he seemed to take it well. You know, he said he didn't seem to reject me. And he said something that along the lines of, well, I'm sure you're not the only one that's done that, and maybe that will help someone someday, or something along that line. And I remember vaguely in the back of my mind thinking, well, that sounds a little bit like the AA party line, but he seemed to be okay with it and didn't reject me, so I kind of moved on. I went home that night, And I think it was within the next day or two, I had my shift changed at work. And all of a sudden, I'm working from 4 to midnight on the swing shift. And I don't go, my whole meeting pattern changed around. Now I'm going to a lot of noon meetings. And I didn't see Billy for months and months and months, good part of a year, I think. And one night, I went to, on my night off, I went to a night meeting that I normally would never go to. And the meeting's getting ready to start. And there's Billy across the room. And it was good to see him because he was such an integral part of my early sobriety. And I said, Billy, hey, Billy, how you doing? And Billy looked right through me. And he wouldn't say hi to me. And he looked at me and then averted his eyes. And he had this look on his face of contempt. A look as if he was saying, oh, get away from me. You know, you... And I sat down in the meeting, and the meeting started, and I didn't hear nothing in the meeting. You know, I'm in my head. I'm grinding away. I'm hurt. Because I know what's going on here. I know. I know, because I know Billy's judging me for that stuff I told him. And there, I guess, there's a part of me that can't blame him. God knows I've judged myself so harshly for that stuff. And I was secretly believed that if you really knew about me what I know about me, you would feel about me the way I feel about me. And the truth is, I don't feel too good about me. Now, I may cover that up with a lot of bravado, but the real truth, I ain't big on me. And so I knew that he was judging me for that stuff. He'd gone home and thought about it and realized, God, that Bob, oh man, what a, jeez. And I'm sitting there and I'm hurt. Now I'm starting to get angry, because I always get angry when I'm hurt. And I get angry and I'm starting to build my case. And my case is, well, that hypocritical SOB, you know, he told me all that stuff. You know, he's been judging me. That phony guy's been judging me. And then I got this epiphany experience. I thought, wait a minute, it's more than that. It's not that he's just judging me. The reason he can't look me in the eye, he's been telling everybody that stuff. And it all, the picture got so focused in my mind. There was a girl I'd just asked out, and she wouldn't go out with me, and she was a friend of his. Oh. There was another guy that he hangs out with, and now that I think about it, he was being a little distant. I'll kill him. I'm going to kill him. And I'm just sitting there, and I imagine steam might have been coming out my ears. I am just cooking, and I'm waiting for the end of the meeting, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to beat the crap out of him, and I'm going to feel justified doing that, because if he's done that to me, he's probably done it to other newcomers. I'm probably doing AA a service. They'll build a statue for me somewhere. This is a good deal. And I'm cocked and ready. I'm ready, man. I'm telling you, I'm hot. I am really hot. And the chairman of the meeting, closing the meeting, says, anybody have a burning desire to share? And Billy raises his hand. He tells everybody in the room that the tumor they'd found recently, he found out that day, was malignant and was terminal, and he had a very short time to live. And I sat there, and I felt this big. I sat there and realized that on the day he found out he was under a death sentence, that he was dying, that saying hi to Bob was not a big priority. That the day he found out he was dying, that he was probably so afraid in his head as I would have been, that he didn't even notice me or anybody else was there. He was so scared. And I realized that Billy had never judged me or did anything except try to help me. And it was like a postcard from God. Dear Bob, you don't know crap. Love God. And I'll tell you, I often think back to that moment and I cringe at what I think my life hung by a thread. If I would have gone up and beat the crap out of him and found out later that I did it and he never did nothing against me and I beat him up on the day he found out he was terminally ill, I would have never been able to come back here. I would have gone and drank myself to death. The shame and remorse would have been... There was a thing in my childhood that from in the Catholics, and I never understood it until recently, and I got sober. They used to talk about mortal sins. sins that were so grave that you never came back from them without an infusion of grace from God. And that I don't think there's anything I could ever do that God would turn on me. He can't do anything except love me. But I think that there are things that I can do. I can damage my own spirit to the point where I will never be able to turn back to Him. He will wait patiently, hoping, and maybe putting people in my life trying to turn me around. But I think I could render mortal blows to my own spirit. That has nothing to do with God. It's all about me. So that these wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. And this was a great turning point for me, because I thought to myself, and I remember this when I was finally doing it, a little over 4 years sober, when I really did my first real inventory. If I could be that wrong about that, if my perception could be that off about that, could I be wrong about some of these other judgments I had about people? Was I really prepared to get off the throne of judgment? Was I prepared to quit playing God? Was I able to come down to earth and do what it says at the bottom of the page? After all the death threats in the whole book, on this whole page, it says the very last two sentences on the last paragraph, full paragraph, it says, "We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol." Well, it's spending the whole page telling me to get rid of this stuff, and then it says, "Oh, and by the way, you can't." What the hell did you tell me for? I am once again in a trap I can't spring. I have to have God's help. And this was our course. This is, matter of fact, this is the course. This is it. This is where the freedom comes. This is where I get the change of perception, the change of consciousness. This is where I start to reduce the separation between me and those people I've judged so harshly. This is where I begin to dismantle the judgment machine. This was our course. We realized, which means I have to make this real. I have to, with inside myself, connect the dots. I got to really get something here that I've never gotten before. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Well, I could get that. Yeah, they're sick and they're idiots too. I mean, I could get that. But it doesn't stop there. It goes on to expand upon it a little bit more. It says, though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, that they, this people I hate, like ourselves, like me, that they are like me, sick too. What's that mean? That means I've got to realize something. I've got to get honest enough with myself, get off the high horse, come down to earth, and put myself in their shoes. I have to realize how if I was raised the way they were raised, if I was afraid the way they were afraid, if I were crazy the way they were, if I was stoned the way they were stoned, if I had all the combinations of history and emotions going on inside of me that were going on inside of them, I could easily have done to another human being exactly what they did to me. And I probably would have hated myself for doing it. But never, ever believe that I'm above that. If the things in my life that I haven't done have actually been by God's grace, not by my virtue, you get me scared enough, you get me backed into a corner enough, and no matter how high my moral judgments are in my character, I am capable of doing things, as my history and past will show you, that I can't stand myself for later. My whole life was a series of those events. And I started to see that and put myself in their shoes and imagined what it must have been like to be that person, and how would I have had to feel about myself to treat another human being the way they treated me. And I started, for the first time in my life, to have some compassion and understanding. A thing that in step 10 says that we are to grow in this understanding and effectiveness. And the understanding really begins right here. When I make that realization. And some of those realizations I can't make on my own. And there's a prayer. It said, we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I had a guy a few years ago, well, 10 or so years ago, he had this really bad resentment towards somebody at work that he dealt with. And I told him to say that prayer on the top of page 67. And I didn't see him for a while, and then I ran into him in a meeting, and I said, so how's that resentment going with the guy at work? And he had this blank look on his face, and he went, oh yeah. He says, I don't have that anymore. I said, really? I said, you're saying the prayer, and it went away. I said, what happened? He said, well, I was asking God to help me show them the same patience, pity, and tolerance I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And I was saying that, and then all of a sudden, I started having this fantasy. And the fantasy was, What if that guy, his erratic behavior that really bugs me and his aggressiveness, what if I found out he really had a brain tumor? What if I found out that he had this brain tumor, it was pressing on his brain and making him act erratic and like uptight all the time? How would I feel about the guy then? And I said, man, I would feel sorry for him. I wouldn't be mad at a guy who can't help it. I wouldn't be pissed at a guy who's got a brain tumor and acting erratically. And then he said, I thought back in my own life of how sometimes my emotional illness of alcoholism at times put the screws to me, and how I was just as helpless at some of the way I treated people as if I would have had a brain tumor. And he said, I started to understand that this guy was like me at times. That maybe he could no more help being the way he was than I could at the times when I've hurt a lot of people and didn't mean to. And he said he started having compassion and understanding for this guy. And he said he stopped reacting to him and his craziness and started treating him like a sick guy. And he said the whole relationship changed between him and that guy. And he became the only friend that guy had, and the guy didn't have any friends at work. He became his only friend, his only go-to guy. There was a guy years ago, it's probably close to 15 years ago that I was sponsoring. And we got into his fifth step, and we got about a third of the way through it. And this is from this guy, I learned to ask for the worst stuff first and get it out of the way, because he'd buried this. It was his worst resentment. He buried it about a third to a half of the way through. And it was for his father. And he came from an alcoholic home. And his dad was a bad drunk. And his dad, on many, many occasions, would be drunk and just beat this little boy. I mean, till he ended up in the emergency room. I mean, just it was horrible. And then there were other times when his father would be hungover and remorseful and be swearing off and feel so guilty for what he did that he'd make all these promises. I'm going to get you a bicycle and I'm going to take you to Disneyland. And always the alcoholism would reassert itself and he'd go back to being the same way. And he never came through on any of these hundreds of promises. And then other times he'd be hungover and irritable and uptight. And sometimes that was even worse, because then he would scream and yell and shut up. And you're making, go to your room, you're stupid, don't say anything. And this kid grew up with that and it owned him. And he had spent years in therapy, in gestalt therapy, beating pillows and putting his father, imagining his father in a chair and screaming and yelling at the chair and then going and getting in the chair and responding back and doing all the gestalt chair stuff. And he tried everything. And all he ever got was little moments of kind of relief and then back to the same thing. It never really changed for him. And it affected his ability to have relationships with women. It affected his ability to maintain a job, to be a team player, to work for a boss, to be of service. The guy was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had this inability to go and be a team player and be a service, because he had this authority thing going on, and he couldn't stop being defensive and all that stuff at work. And this owned him. So we're going through this, and he's talking about his father and column number one and column number two, what his father did and all the things his father did, and what was hurt, threatened, affected, or interfered with. Everything, his self-esteem, his pride, his ambitions, his relationships, everything was just destroyed. And Then we started talking about this was our course. And I started reading that the part out of the book, and I said, you know, you have to realize how your dad was like you, possibly sick. You have to see how you're like your father, and you could have done the same thing. And I couldn't even finish the thought. He started yelling at me. And he started yelling at me, what do you mean I'm not like my father? My father was an animal. My father was the most selfish. And he went, all this venom started pouring out. And I just back off because I'm sitting there thinking, this guy is not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. I mean, I get that. Okay. And I don't know, and I'm afraid to push it because I think he's going to hit me. He's like got all this anger. And I've always been intimidated by extreme anger anyway. So that's my deal. So I backed off and I said, well, let's go on with the next resentment. He starts in the next resentment and I don't even hear what he's saying because I got something going on in me. And what was going on in me was not of me, but I think it was through me. And I think the reason it was going on is before I hear a fifth step, I get the guy who's going to say it to ask God in. And I sit there quietly and I ask God to help me be useful. And I, as my friend Bob B says, I'm never the well, but sometimes I get to be the pipe. And what's came up next is I'm something that I'm not bright enough to get. And I stopped him halfway through that resentment, and it just this intuitive thing was strong on me. And I said to him, I said, I'd like to go back to another resentment. He said, yeah, you want to go back to my father, huh? No, no, I do not want to go back to that. I want to go back to that one in the beginning, that woman with the kids that you were involved with for those years. He said, what of it? I said, you know, I was just wondering if any time in that relationship when you were drunk or on drugs or hungover, if you ever did anything to hurt those kids. And he put his head down, and when his head came up, he had tears running down his cheek. I'll never forget this voice in the most choked, pained whisper, like from the pit of hell. He said, I'm just like my goddamn father. I said, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He said, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, do you think you're any different from your dad? And he said, he got this funny look on his face. And he said, you know, my dad lives in this little shabby trailer. He's all alone. He's got liver damage and he's got pancreatitis. And he has been forced by a body that will not metabolize alcohol into a state of abstinence. And he is the most neurotic, negative, fear-filled, lonely person on the planet. He is in hell. Nobody has anything to do with him. I haven't seen him in a few years. We've all just written him off. None of his kids will talk to him. Nobody has anything to do with him, and he's dying. And I said, do you think you could be like that? And he got a faraway look, and he said, you know something? That could be a vision of my future. And he saw something in his father he had never seen. He could never see past himself in his own judgment. He finally saw himself in his father. Maybe not exactly the same. Maybe the circumstances were a little different. But he could see himself in his father. And he started the amends process. He did the last part. The last part, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. In other words, I can't use their bad behavior to shore up what I've done. I have to look at my behavior in its own light as if, what if this person was perfect? Then what kind of a son was I? What if this boss was perfect? Then what kind of an employee was I? What if that gal was perfect? Then what kind of a partner was I? And I made a career of hiding my behavior, diminishing my behavior, keeping it in the shade of your bad behavior so I don't have to look at it. The book says, disregard the other person involved entirely. And I tell you, one of the things I used to say here in this part of the step, and I think it's a dangerous thing for me to say, even though it's common verbiage in AA, is, oh, in this part, we're looking for our part. It doesn't say that in the book. It doesn't say I'm looking for my part. And the reason it doesn't say that, it says disregarding the other person involved entirely. If I'm looking for my part, there isn't This is a whole. If I look for my part, the implication is they got a part too. I'm still hanging on to the fact that they have a part. And I would say that in meetings. I'd say, well, this part, we're looking for my part. And then one day I'm with a guy who I sponsor who's going to make amends, and he's talking about it, and I get it. That because he's looking for his part, he's going into the amends with an expectation that now I've humbled myself and cleaned up my side of the street. I've dealt with my part, and come on, I'll help you, remember? The book says in the amends part, it says never criticize such a person, never, their faults are not discussed, we stick to our own. And I have to look at, I can't hide behind your wrongdoings. And if I can do that, then it's the first time in my life I've ever stood up and not hid behind the wrongdoings of others and stood up and taken the responsibility for what kind of a son I was. What kind of an employee was I? What kind of a partner was I? What kind of a brother was I? And I'll tell you something, in that light, it's not good. I was a lousy son, and I could find a few things my wonderful parents, but if you look at them the right way, you can find stuff. You could, if you looked at Mother Teresa with the perception of a judgmental alcoholic, you could find flaws in Mother Teresa. You could find flaws in anybody. And I would hide behind those flaws. And this guy, he looked at what kind of a son he was, and he realized the amends and how he'd retaliated and how he'd helped turn all the other, his brothers and sisters against his father and all the people in the family by bad rapping him and talking, just getting everybody against him. And he went to his father to make the amends. And he told me the story. He says, when I went to the trailer, and he said, there was a knot in the pit of my stomach of fear. He said, because I was afraid I'm facing the monster of my childhood. And what opened the door was a sick, dried up, dying little old man who was pathetic and alone and scared and shaking. And he said, my father of my childhood was gone. And he said, what I saw was I saw me. That's me. That's me without God's grace. That's me. And he said, I was able to love my father. I was loving really the me that is in him. The me that could have been him. And he was able to sit there and make his amends to his father, which was a very prolonged thing. And what he really did is he took care of his father until his father died. And he loved him. And he thanked him for all the good stuff. Because even Attila the Hun had a good day occasionally. And he thanked him for all the good stuff. And he'll tell you to this day that next to getting his sobriety, the greatest gift Alcoholics Anonymous ever gave him is he got his daddy back. And that is a tremendous change in consciousness. And it all starts from a willingness to be wrong. Was I wrong about these people? Can I stand to be wrong? Do I know that I don't know? Can I look at these from an entirely different angle? And if we can do that, tremendous things happen. I'll tell you a quick little story and then we'll break for lunch. I haven't used this example in a few years. Somebody reminded me recently that I should still use it. And I haven't used it because, I mean, when a resentment's gone, it's so gone I don't even remember it anymore. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like it's gone. And I'm around this person on every day now. When I was a few years sober, I got married, make decisions based on self. You could have put me on a lie detector, and I would have thought this was God's will. This marriage, I have an amazing capacity to delude myself. Really, you know what's going on? Is I'm wanting to fill. I still got a hole inside me, and I want to fill. And I'm looking around, and I got it. My job's doing good now, and this is going good. This good. What could it be? Wait a minute. It feels like a woman-shaped hole. Yeah, that's it. I need to be married. Because I'd look around, I'd see people really happy, and I got that, got that, got that. Got, wife, don't have a wife. Need a wife. My first sponsor told me I would have married anybody I was dating at that point in my life.